Boogie Dillon. Boogie Dillon.
Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we'll be featuring legendary drummer, professional singer, songwriter, and visionary artist, Ralph Kinsey. Let's roll! Ralph Kinsey, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Thank you, Ange, for having me.
So how did the Kinsey Report start out?
The man responsible for that is Big Daddy, our father, my dad, Big Daddy Kinsey. His name is Lester Kinsey, but when he started performing, he was a big man, so Big Daddy became his stage name. And like a lot of, like many black, millions of black families, my family was one of those that made that pilgrimage from the South, North. I don't know if you know the story, Ange, but from the middle 1900s, right after World War One, a little before World War One, up to the 1970s, it's estimated that six or seven million black people made that trek up north. So when I think about that kind of volume, and I said, well, my parents, they were in that. And,
right.
They came to Gary, and from Gary, my father was always musically inclined. They came from the state of Mississippi, and from a little village called Pleasant Grove. Pleasant Grove is not well known, but there were other major villages: Clarksdale, Marks, Tupelo, Crenshaw. So all these were other like larger villages around Pleasant Grove, but that's where they came from. Maybe 70, 80 miles south of Memphis, they call it the Hills. Panola County, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where all the guys came. You know, Muddy Waters, Wolf, all them guys, they...
Johnny Hooker, they're all from Oklahoma County and Clarksdale. Yeah.
Mississippi has an amazing history, man.
Yeah.
You know, something that perplexes me about it, and I ponder about it. One of the most racist states in the country.
Right.
And this is what they produced. You know, that conflict, when I think about it, and all this great music that
it came from
funneled to
Mississippi, came from the Delta.
That's where my parents came from. And but my dad started playing as a child. And so all his heroes were our heroes. Muddy Waters, you know, Magic Sound. All the greats. That's all the people that he admired, we ended up admiring, you know. I just think about Learn to Love Me or Leave Me, the one you want to do, Junior Parker.
Right.
I mean, this was regular, this was like regular stuff in our home.
In your household, yeah.
So, once, you know, he played, when they all got, after they got here, because this is dynamic to the thing, Ange, because at that time, families would bring other families up. And that's what my grandfather did. He ended up coming after my father did. He came up and bought a hotel and brought many families up and started a church. And so the church was on 2456 Chase Street. It was called just Church of God of Christ. It didn't evolve into the Powers Church of God of Christ. But like many other entertainers, that's where I saw my first live musicians,
right,
in the church. And my first live drummer right there in the pulpit with my granddad preaching, I'm saying. And the spirit, my dad picking the guitar, it would be on any given Sunday or weekday when we'd have the service, any brass, keyboards, singers, whatever you can make a joyful noise on, you were welcome.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, but this is the environment that we came up in, and that's where the Kinsey Report evolved from. Once they must have had a keen sense of us, because some of our first toys were musical instruments.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about like 1956, you know, 55. We had a little toy. We had our cowboy guns and all that. That was the thing too. But we got little instruments, man. And it was such a pleasure to see our father play, and his friends enjoying him playing. It was just like, so you got that atmosphere at home. Then you go to church and see that other side of it. So it was like those two worlds that's what we were kind of immersed in, and we fell in love with it. I fell in love with it. I was called to the drums.
I was going to ask you, did you choose the drums, or did the drums
they
choose you?
They called me. When I was sitting there in the church there, I couldn't wait, until I get home and get butter knives. And so they said, well, this boy going to be a drummer. And my brother, I'm left-handed too, so I guess he would have tried to teach me guitar. But being left-handed, he had no patience for dealing with what I was dealing with. Mm-hmm. So my brother Don picked up the guitar, and that was easy for him to learn like that. So once we got the ages of maybe 10, 11, 12, 13, we started playing local picnics, musicians' picnics, and little what they call cabarets and things like that. So,
this was behind your father?
Yes. We had... Trying to think of some of the names of the band. it was Big Daddy Kenzie and his Fabulous Sons. Big Daddy Kenzie, Soul Satisfaction Band. The Constellations. We had all those kind of band names like that.
So at that time, you got a taste of the music and performing. And I mean, did it come naturally?
I think it did, Ange. But at the same time, you had to apply yourself, even with all the natural potential you had, one still has to apply itself to the instrument. And so in showing us how to play music, and I got to regress because long before it was music, it was noise. So I appreciate our mother and my mother because she allowed us to develop.
Right.
And it was, like I said, it was noise much before it was music. So she put up with that, and her house, we would have the musicians come by. And our friends, we go and practice at their house. Their mothers and fathers allowed us to do it. So it was like a little area group of young men that want to be musicians. And but we just endure it, I should say. And and one of the first lessons that we learned in learning to play and learning the instrument, we would have listening sessions. He would just call us in. We got pictures of it. My mother, she was keen too because she took pictures of everything. Those old Kodak black and white, man. But we would just have listening sessions, and he said, I want y'all to learn this. I want you to listen to this and try to learn the feel of this. Try to get this into you. And many nights we listened like 2 or 3 hours just listening, not even playing the instruments, just, listening for the sound, the feel, how the music moved and everything. So, but
That's a great lesson because so many people make music and they're not really sure how good or bad it is, and listening it really forces you, because I think a key thing in music is listening to the other musicians,
exactly,
but also listen to yourself,
exactly,
and hear,
exactly,
hear how it's happening.
Exactly. I remember back in the day when that record Scratch My Back by Slim Harpo, it was a very popular record, and some way my dad got involved with a promoter that was kind of shady and was promoting him as Slim Harpo.
Okay.
And, they did a few cities like Peoria and a couple more cities, but he still found that that's not the way to go. But
sure.
In doing that, we had to learn Scratch My Back. And we would sit down, literally for hours, and just listen to the feel of how they did that, because that's the way he wanted it. And when we were backing him, we were doing cover tunes like that before we started writing. We had to get it try to get it as close to the record as you could first, and then add, you know, your embellishment. Yeah, but he was very keen on learn what you're listening to at first, and then we'll take it somewhere else. So, but that's how the Kenneth's Report evolved, and my younger brother Kenneth came along. Had no idea that he was going to play bass, but as we became younger men, we formed a band called White Lightning. And it's a little history before that. That was a band that one member of the band was called Buster. His name was Mac Jones, but his stage name was Buster Cherry Jones. He's from Memphis. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking the years now. Mid-1970s, and after I finished high school, and we still had bands and everything, but my dad became a little ill, so we weren't really playing like we were.
Okay.
Like we were. And now I'm 18 years old. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with myself, and I didn't feel I was college material at that point for what I thought I knew.
Right.
But anyway, I went to the Air Force. I joined the Air Force. I thought that would be a good experience for myself, and end up spending time up in upstate New York. So I did that and came home. And about that time, I'm getting ahead of myself. I got to go back a little bit, Ange, and tell you this. Because as we were coming up in Gary playing music like that, all those bands that I mentioned earlier, we had a reputation for being pretty good. So being in Gary, any band going east or west, they had to come through 94. You know, you're going to Chicago, sure. You're going to Cleveland. And there was a club in Gary. It was called Clayman Show Club Lounge. It's on 15th Avenue, West Gary. Everybody played there, man. Bobby Womack, Staple Singers, Ohio Players, Bobby Bland.
So you're exposed to all this great music.
But the thing about it, my dad had a relationship with the club owner, uh-huh. And he allowed us to open the shows.
Nice.
Albert King.
Yeah.
Well, that's how my brother and my dad and Albert King met.
Okay.
And from that, Albert needed a guitar player at that time, and he was just passing through. I think he had a lady here too, perhaps, but
right.
He was playing Chicago also. I think, what's that club on the south side? High Chaparral?
Okay.
Something like that.
Stony Island,
Yeah, he was doing something like that. But they would lay over in Gary, and he needed a guitar player. He told him, he asked my father, Big Daddy, I can take Don Light on the road. I think he can handle it. So I have to confer with my mother. And he said, okay, I think it'd be good for him. He had finished school. So he did that. And a couple of years passed. I got out the Air Force. And he and Buster figured they wanted to do something else. So they left Albert's band. They all come back to Gary. I come back to Gary. We formed this band called White Lightning. Three-piece rock and roll blues band. And we played around Gary for a little while. And but we had other ambitions. The young man Buster Jones, Mac Jones, he ended up, what had happened before he got with Albert King's band, he was over in England, and at this time, this was when Brian Phelps, the Sharks, this is when the Sex Pistols and all this stuff was just beginning to start happening in England. He was over there at the beginning of all that, so he had all that, but he was from Memphis,
mm-hmm.
So he had a certain...
Sure, oh, soul,
he was, oh man, he was a dynamic bass player and entertainer. So he came back, did the Albert King gig. My brother come back home. We formed White Lightning. And while they were out with Albert and he was over in England, they had met people and said, and the people told them that if we can get some songs, we might be able to do something for you, do something with you. So again, we came back to Gary. All of us come back to Gary. Played Gary for maybe a year, wrote some songs, and contacted people that told us they can get us a record deal. Sent them the cassette, sent them the tape, and they said, yeah, we think we can get you a deal. You come to New York, we put you up, and we'll take it from there. So we loaded up all our equipment on the train, and Fifth Avenue and Chase Street in Gary. Caught the Amtrak all the way to New York Central Station. Got off, man. It's my first time in New York City. But true to their word, they met us there. And the people that we had got involved with, little did we know. Our manager's name at that time was Gary Kerfers. He was best friends with Felix Pappalardi. So Felix Pappalardi is famous for Mountain, The Little Rascals, probably other artists that I don't know. Right. Leslie West, Mountain, all that. Felix Pappalardi, so Cream.
Sure.
So, but we had no idea of these things. But these are the people that we had got ourselves involved with. And so they said, well, we can get you a record deal. So we rehearsed. They put us up in the Village there. We lived in Chelsea Hotel for about 2 months. And just, you know, did what musicians do.
Right.
And but they were true to their word. They got us a deal with Island Records. Island Records at that time was just beginning to break in America. And Lively Up Yourself, the Bob Marley record was beginning to come out. But let me go back. The White Lightning record came out. But this is the history of that record. Felix Pappalardi produced it, sang on it. We did the record in Memphis at Sun Studios. The history of Sun Studios, Sam Phillips.
Right, Elvis, and Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins.
The same room, man, all these people, you know.
Little Milton.
That's what I'm talking about, Ange. And we did the record there. The record turned out well, man, but and we toured. We opened for, they took us straight from Gary, Indiana to the stage. We were with Premier Talent. We were opening for Peter Frampton, the Average White Band, ZZ Top, Uriah Heep. I mean, they put us.
You were on the fast track.
I'm telling you, man. But the thing, musically, it was good. But the album cover was very controversial, man. And it pains me to say this because I know better now. I didn't give no okay on nothing like that. You know, the album cover was done. I said, okay, cool.
Right. You're just excited to be in that scene, right?
You know. But the album was by the same artist that did Malcolm Davis' Bitches Brew. Just abstract.
Right.
Black and white bodies. And they wanted to break the record in Atlanta, Georgia, at Alex Cooley's ballroom. They wouldn't put posters of the record up, man, because he was just. But it was, you know, Mick Jagger came down. It was a very enlightening adventure because it put us on another understanding of the business.
On a higher level, too, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we did the record and toured the country. Came back to New York, but our bass player Buster had some issues, as some bands go through from time to time. Mm-hmm. He had some issues, Brothers, Donald and I, we couldn't deal with it.
Right.
We didn't come like that.
Sure.
And he didn't either. But he had issues. So we just had to part our ways. And we come back home. And that was actually really the beginning of the Kings Report. But my brother got a phone call, and that's a whole nother story. And so after those years that he spent with working with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh.
And was that through the Island Records connection?
All that was through the Island Records. And our manager, Gary Kerfers, he managed Toots and the Maytals and Peter Tosh.
All right.
So it was, man, it's just like he fell into it and we fell into it by catching that train going to New York. And so long story short, to capitalize it, Kenuff had come of age. He was playing the bass real good. And we already had a rhythm, a ready-made rhythm section. So after doing all that, Peter got killed. This music is something. When they did the Mama Africa album, which was one of his greatest selling records, my brother convinced him to do Johnny B. Goode.
You're talking about Peter Tosh.
Right. So I'm down there too. I'm in Jamaica because, you know, at that time we had learned from White Lightning that it's about trying to get your songs established.
Right.
So we were working with Danny Sims. Danny Sims is responsible for like Johnny Nash, all the kind of he worked with all the Peters, the Platters. He's longtime black entrepreneur in music from way back. He's passed on now. But he was working with Peter Tosh and Betty Wright, and they needed songs. And we had began writing songs, and they had, some of our songs caught their attention. And we were fortunate to get two of our songs on Betty Wright's album, Right Back At You record. And we got one of our songs on the Peter Tosh record, that Mama Africa, Where You Gonna Run. So, but after all that had been said and done, we thought it was time to come back home and work on the home front. And so about 1982, 83, that's when we really put it together as Big Daddy Kinsey and the Kinsey Report. We were playing this little club on the south side of Chicago, Brady's Lounge, Diamond Jim Brady. I never forget him, bless his soul. We play his club every Sunday from 9 in the evening to 3 in the morning, and everybody would come down there. At that time, Cotton was in town, Junior Wells, Johnny, I want to call him Johnny Love, but it wasn't Johnny Love. Johnny Good Dollar. Something
Johnny
like
Dollar.
That.
Johnny Dollar, yeah.
But everybody would come down there, man. And that little stage was that big, man. But we had drum set. I had a full drum set, keyboard, right behind the bar. And we did that, if my memory serves me right, pretty much close to a year. And Mr. Brady was... he was a policy guy, big time. They call him Diamond Jim Brady. But he wasn't a taker, he was a giver. He'd take care of the neighborhood. I mean, people loved him. You know, we park over there, nobody would bother our car. Nobody. Because they know, you know, he could be good to you, but on the other side, he could, you know. Yeah, so you don't mess with him, but he was good, man. Yeah. He had a good heart. Yeah. He told my father, he said, Big Daddy, you and your boys got a good thing. Y'all need to make a record. And Papa said, yeah, well, we're working on that. Mr. Brady, we're working on that. He said, well, I'll finance it. Y'all find out where you want to do it, I'll finance it. We did the record. Things came together. Jim O'Neill picked it up. It was called Big Daddy Kinsey and the Kinsey Report, Bad Situation. We did that record, I think, in 83, 84, something like that. And it took us all over the world.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the beginning of my education, my real education. In life, as a man and as a musician and as a citizen of the world. Because in some of those early tours, one of the early tours I remember, we went over and we did the normal things that we do when you go over there. And this promoter came to the promoter that brought us over there and said that he had some extra dates. He had 3 weeks in Eastern Europe. If we wanted to do it, if we can work out an agreement, we could do it. Yeah, man, we said we already over there. Sure. Might as well go, you know. So we worked out an agreement and... But we end up going to Poland, Bulgaria, at that time Yugoslavia. And eastern part of Germany, Magdeburg or something like that. But what was, it was my first time, but the response of the people, Ange, was like, they'd been waiting on us, man. Like, where you been?
Right.
You know, some of them had the records from Rooster, and they treated us most kindly, man. So then that gave me another perspective on looking at the thing. One thing that stands out in my mind, too, on one of those Poland tours was that after we performed, they would have like a question and answer seminar. They'd ask you questions. And, you know, we thinking we're going to talk about blues and things related, and which we did.
Yeah.
But they would ask you, like, we don't see the American Indian. Where's the American Indian at? I'm saying, I wasn't really prepared for that, you know.
But you get a whole different perspective in the world.
Yes, and so it made me come back home and get prepared. I thought that I better study a little bit more of the history of what I do, of the music, and what it has done. And I'm still a student. I'm learning every day. And
but now you're an ambassador.
That's what I found. Right. That's what I realized.
Yeah.
That's the consciousness that I came to. And so after we did that record and toured, people started taking notice of us like that. And
well, from your father's point of view, do you think that was something that he had always wanted to have, to have his sons back him up in the band?
I'm sure that was the ultimate.
So he had to be very proud of that.
Very, I mean, I think about some of the moments that we spent together, and it's ironic that you kind of mentioned that, because I was reflecting on this a few weeks ago. It was at that time, BB had that club in Memphis down there.
On Beale Street. Yeah.
And it was happening. It was just, you know, it was new, it was fresh. And at that time, we were playing it. And our mother, she traveled, but she didn't travel that much. And so, but we were going down south. She was going because Memphis is right close to home.
Right.
So she saw some of her people. And we played this club, man, and it was, people were falling off. It was packed, man. I mean, it was, I can't express it, man. And mother got a chance to experience that and see her sons and her husband on stage with their friends laying this thing down and people like just going. And I reflected on that, like I said, a few weeks ago. I can only imagine how she must have felt.
It's got to warm your heart, too.
You know, and it just makes you want to honor that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really honor that, because, you know, they put up with a whole lot of stuff, man, especially from a term in terms of a house like that. All these strange people coming in a house.
Making all that noise.
Drinking again, oh, man. But yeah, that was a warm moment that I know touched her, and I thought about it a few weeks ago, and it touched me too. But from that, Alligator Records have been watching us too along the way. I laugh, man, because I'm thinking about these little joints we used to play.
Right.
It was a part of Gary that they called a small farm. It was, you know where the expressway is down 20. The expressway, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go a little bit north of the expressway, they call it the small farms there, 25th Avenue and Gary. And it was a little, it was gambling houses and all kind of little joints back there, but it was a place called Joe Green's. And that's where all the Chicago guests would come and play.
Right.
Or gamble or whatever. It was a speakeasy. And we played this place down there called the White Rose, man. It was like, you drive down in there, you go through. If you didn't know how to get out, you were going to get lost, man. You drive all these cars, man. And the place was a white building. Nice. I mean, very nice looking building. Yellow lights. You go in there. But those are the kind of places that we kind of like cut our teeth at. And our father, sometime my father would catch a little hell about that, because he was the son of a minister and have his sons out there in the world, as they call it, like that. But we were together. He would never leave us nowhere.
In some ways, he was sort of still protecting you.
Exactly. Yeah. He would never put us, you go over there and stay, I'll be back. No, we were always together. And introduced us to this, you know, at my Spurs speakeasy with my father, you know, playing music, you know, seeing all the pimps and the players.
Sure.
But they weren't, man, they weren't bothering nobody. It wasn't like the young kids are doing today. That's so disheartening too, Ange, because I know where it come from. I lived a part of that, of taking care of each other, not trying to take out each other, taking care of each other to make grow. And we're so far away from that, Ange. So any voice that I can lend to help that, man, I want to do that too, because like I said, my granddad, he invested and brought them up, man, and put them in a place so they can get started on their own. And that's what they did.
And they flourished.
That's what they did, man.
It grew. And in some ways, maybe music is a great vehicle to do that.
It did for us, man. My children don't play. They were around it all the time, but they don't play. And I didn't want to force them.
Right.
But they're all artistic. Like your wife, man, they just
right
do it like
they
that.
Probably come out naturally.
You know? But getting back to the, we played that White Rose Club, and Bruce Ziegler was coming around then, and Jim O'Neill, because they was hanging together, mm-hmm. They were running together like that. And they put together this concept to do the new Blue Bloods. And we were auspicious enough to get picked to do that. And ourselves and a lot of our good friends, Maurice, John Vaughn, Billy Branch.
Carl Weathers would be.
All of them. Yeah. We all was got a
That's
chance
a great to record, really.
Get a cut on there. And we did this cut called Give Me a Corner of the Blanket.
Yeah.
You know. Oh, don't be so mean, babe. So, you know, that introduced us again to more people.
And that was just the Kinsey Report.
Just the Kinsey Report,
without your father. Yeah.
And so that led to Alligator approaching us about doing an album. So we talked about it because we didn't know whether we should just stay Big Daddy Kinsey and the Kinsey Report and keep going that way.
Right.
But that was part of the plan, you know. Y'all, you guys, you know, once we get established, you do this and I do this and then we get together, it's going to be even more special. But it turned out, man, it turned out to be what it is, man. Dad ended up getting deals with Gitani's, that French label over there. They were courting him to do things. Johnny Clyde Copeland hanging out with all those folks, man. And so we did the record. The first record we did for Alligator was Edge of the City. Again, that opened more doors for us and made us more of a international band again.
What was the hit, or what was the song?
Full Moon on Main Street.
All right, right.
Full Moon on Main Street was the tune. Black. again, touring, man, we was touring so much, and because this is what we wanted to do. We set out, and
you guys, at some one point, you guys were road dogs. I remember, I mean, still are, but I remember we opened for you guys one time, I think at PJ Flaherty's, and you guys had just come in Evergreen Park, and you guys had just come from, I think, Pittsburgh.
See.
Like that day. You know?
Crazy. But that we had committed ourselves to it like that. And so at its peak, we were doing maybe over 200 dates a year, and three quarters of those were away.
Yeah.
Because we was committed to what we were doing. And I must say, again, after learning the lessons of White Lightning from that point of it,
right,
we were very keen on trying to write our own material and maintain much of ourselves as we can. And because publishing is a very, very great part of music. It's not, the music is more talked about than the publishing, but the publishing is the deal.
Right.
And so, man, they were telling us, but Daddy, I love and honor my dad for this, because he always told us, he said, try to be self-maintained as much as you can. Because if you do it right, when you go to bed at night, you can be earning income.
Yeah. It's funny. My wife talks to me about, you get a little check, and she's like, that's for doing nothing. I'm like, no, I did the work. I did the work, but the check just came in while I was sleeping.
You know? And so, you know, we were admonished about that, and we tried to write, but we did other songs. We did tunes by Prince. We did tunes by John Fogerty and people like that. But we want to establish ourselves a catalog, because we knew that commercials, advertising,
right?
It's publishing and advertising. They all go together, Ange.
They have to have music in their commercial.
But it's a hard road to crack, a hard nut to crack. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know that at the time, but we prepared ourselves to be prepared. And so anyway, we did Edge of the City. It was a good record for us and opened a lot of doors for us. And after that, we did the Midnight Drive record. We have access, but we don't have access. You know, our music, you know, like, and again, you said something before we even started interview. The music has made great strides, you know, great strides. But whenever I hear great white rock and roll hits from, I'm saying, wait, man, it's got to be a slot there somewhere,
right,
for some real American music like this. It's got to be. You know what I mean? I keep hearing the same, and I like the Eagles. I like all that. I appreciate that, but I know it's something else there, Ange.
It's a shame. Well, I had this discussion with my wife the other day. The classic rock station plays these same 20 songs. What about even playing some of the other songs from that album or some of the other great music that was made during that?
That's the very frustrating part at this point for me, Ange, because you know, I know that that's where you could at least, and I didn't get in music truly to make money.
Right.
I got in music because it felt good, you know. It still feels good. I think that's the thing about it that keeps you
in it.
Yeah, man.
Aside from all the other frustrations.
Yeah, man, because it's a feeling that you get. And I get a little aches and pains now.
Yeah.
But in terms of the feeling that I get when I get behind the drums, it's the same feeling that I felt when I was 12 years old.
That's the magic about it, is that joy that it brings.
That's what keeps me. It's like a sanctuary, truly. We did that record, Midnight Drive. It was very, caught a lot of slack for that too, because at that time, apartheid, South Africa was on the pages then, man.
Right.
And we wanted to do songs that spoke to that, and because our grandmother told us many years ago that she said, you know, let your music speak to something, you know, let it speak to something, or you'll fall for anything, you know. So when you become conscious and cognizant of things, you can't turn a blind eye.
No, you don't want to sing another My Baby Left Me song. You want to say something to your audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let them know that if you ain't thinking, we're thinking. You know, and you ought to be thinking.
Right.
And so, man, we fought hard to get Free South Africa on that record. Even Midnight Drive, because it was kind of out of Alligator's realm of doing things at that time.
Right.
But it was one of the biggest records. So you have to fight for what you believe in.
And I think that comes in, you guys are artists. You're not musicians, just musicians. Because an artist has more to say than just plunking out some chords and lead guitar, right?
And just is, and now that the time is we're in today, and I can remember, I'll get back to what we did after Midnight Drive record, but just reflecting on times. Again, my parents were from Pleasant Grove, Mississippi, so for us, summer camp was going back to Mississippi in the summertime. Now, we were going back to Mississippi in 55, 56, 57. A lot of stuff was going on down south.
And that's a long way from what was happening up north in Chicago and in Gary, right?
And our mother would always admonish us. I don't know what it was, but after studying the history of Cairo, Illinois, Cairo was very volatile in the history of these United States. But it was also one of the last points that you could stop and fuel.
Right.
So right before we even leave home, she said, be on your best behavior. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Okay, mama. Because that's the way we were raised anyway. But she would always give you an extra of that.
When you're here.
We going down south. And we got down to Cairo one night, man, because we leave late in the evening. And long story short, I went to get a drink of water. And I went to the water fountain, started drinking out the fountain. The guy said, no, you can't do that. You got to drink out the hose. And I kind of eased away from Mama and them. They didn't know where I was at. So they just kind of came back and got me and went on, got about the way. Didn't really talk about it too much from that point. But that was my first encounter with something is a little different here.
Right.
But when we get down to Mississippi, because my mother's parents, they stayed down there. They didn't come up north. My father's parents did. Man, we get down to Mississippi, man, all you got is smiles. And
sure.
You never would have known. I never would have known that my grandparents couldn't vote.
Yeah.
Or that there was a poll tax or just all these kind of repressive measures against them. I never had an idea about it. Because all I got, all we felt was love and glad to see you, man.
Sure.
And Big Daddy played the box a little bit for us, uh-huh. Son. You know?
Right.
And
but love can make a lot of that stuff go away.
That's what it. And I think about where they come from, Pleasant Grove. They call their little village Pleasant Grove. And what must have been pleasant about it was the love.
The people, the families, and yeah.
Yeah, man. So.
And that's a great, you know, that's a great lesson to figure that out as a child.
Man.
Like the rest of this world is kind of upside down, but this little spot here on Earth is a wonderful little patch, you know.
Man, we go down there and play, run in the mud, the sky, no glass on the ground.
Yeah.
Rocks, feet be a little tender about the rocks, but man, you know, just free.
Yeah.
You know, and but we had great relatives, Ange, because my great aunt, that's another thing, I really didn't get a chance to know a lot of them folks because that's just the way it was. But she made homebrew.
Okay.
And once she found out that we could play and we was pretty halfway good, we set up in front of a place. And she had a little big, not big, but big enough we can set up. People come in the garden. And she sell a homebrew. And
wow.
We play music and just party.
And it's a party, yeah.
And the law didn't do nothing because this is Andy. So they know she wasn't going to get too outrageous.
Sure.
So, I mean, music has brought much favor, too, you know, because we weren't out there fighting and gangbanging, trying to do this. We were trying to play music and trying to learn our craft and
make people happy, make people dance. I mean,
that's what,
the reaction you get.
And you want to be a part of that, man. You want to be on some side of that.
Tune in next week for part two of my interview with Ralph Kinsey.